This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The performing arts took a huge hit at the height of the pandemic, and now with the Delta variant creating concern for folks who had hoped to get back to doing things pre-COVID, what is the future of live in-person performances, and how did art centers handle not having audiences? With us now to tell us more about what happened this past year and what to expect coming up is Jeffrey C. McDermott, President and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts and the Great American Songbook Foundation. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
What was the last year and a half like for the Center for the Performing Arts?
I've joked with some people that it was the longest and maybe in some ways the shortest year of our lives. It was a year that in some respects didn't happen. And then it was a year that in many respects allowed us to really stretch our own creativity and deliver on our mission in a wide variety of new ways.
And I think that's really impressive when we hear about how the arts became more creative. Can you even get more creative if you're already in the arts? What were some of the things that you had to do to sort of accommodate what was going on?
On March 12th of 2020, when Governor Holcomb first came down with his executive order and put us in a position, as was appropriate, to have to not have in-person performances with audiences here. We kind of went into high gear. Actually, that day we had the Soldiers Army Band and Soldiers Chorus literally loading in with 1,600 people on their way here for a free concert. And we had to turn them all away because we had to, we couldn't perform. But we went into high gear almost immediately. I put together a group of our most creative people, and that was hard to do because they're all so creative. We formed what we called our Hatch Committee. And the Hatch Committee's goal and their only charge was come up with creative ways to deliver our mission using what's available to us. We immediately went out and purchased 5 high-def cameras and went into live streaming of local and regional artists who could come here without audiences. We kept them employed. We had probably about 2 dozen shows that we called Live at the Center, where we had no audiences, but they performed on our stages and we broadcast them out live to literally thousands of people. We use that same streaming capability to advance our educational programs. And what we found was that we were able to really deliver educational programming to far more people than we've ever been able to deliver before. In a typical year, we would have hundreds of people participate in our programs. Last year, we had tens of thousands. So we found some silver linings in all of it.
Yeah, it's really amazing when I hear time and again from different organizations and folks who turned to technology and found that there was a big benefit to streaming shows, to getting a broader audience that probably never would have been able to come out, maybe in some cases. Are there any stories that you can share with just what it was like to change into that sort of online format and not have that live audience? Were performers still able to perform, or did they need that live feeling?
It was a different feeling, and at times I will say it was a surreal feeling. Our production people felt it probably most because they were so used to, working with the artists in a live audience setting, and so it was different for them. But I think they pretty quickly acclimated to it, and then realized that they could sort of stretch the limits a little bit more. We had the entire space of the hall to use because it wasn't occupied by patrons. And so we could do some things that we hadn't thought of doing before. And we were really fortunate when we went out and purchased all the video equipment to be able to do this. As just dumb luck would have it, my production team from other professional experiences had a lot of video capabilities that we didn't even realize existed within our staff. And so there really wasn't much of a learning curve either. They just went right into video live streaming mode.
And were you able to keep your staff together and performers, or did folks have to pivot to something else during the pandemic?
We were very fortunate. We did not furlough any full-time employees. All of our staff, agreed to take some relatively minor reductions in pay, but we kept everybody employed. And it was really important to me and to our organization to do that. Number one, I knew that if we had to furlough people or let people go, we might not get them back. As things work. And number two, you know, while some arts organizations, and frankly, some organizations not in the arts community, furloughed many people or even, you know, locked up and closed the doors, I thought it was important that we stay open, albeit in a virtual setting for the most part. But it was important for us to do that. I sort of likened it to if you turn off the engine and turn it back on a year and a half later, you're going to probably have some problems with that engine. But if you keep it running, even at a lower gear, it's a lot easier to get it moving again. And I think what we're seeing now as we're ramping up for our new season is exactly that. It is as though we didn't skip a beat. And so we're very fortunate, I think, to have everybody back and have people hitting on all cylinders right now.
Well, that brings me to this next question that I was going to ask, which is how you were able to come out of this lockdown and be able to get programming together. But it seems that since you never really fully halted things and you were able to come up with other scenarios and ways to do it, I'm going to assume that it wasn't too hard to jump back in.
It really wasn't. You know, the programming team all remained employed, and we all met on Teams and Zoom and other platforms. We had a weekly meeting of our programming team, just like we always would. I will say that some of those meetings were short because there wasn't a whole lot to talk about if national and international artists weren't even touring or accepting offers. But we still had our Live at the Center series that we programmed with our local and regional artists. And that really was a feel-good thing for all of us. You know, we did that really to continue advancing our mission and to continue making the music play for our patrons. What I think we didn't fully appreciate is that we were also creating opportunities for the local and regional artists who themselves were not working. And so we brought them in, we paid them. They had experiences here just like any artist would with, you know, our dressing rooms and great concierge services backstage and a very professional production team. They really appreciated what we were able to do for them. And we live streamed all of that free of charge. We just decided that this now wasn't the time to focus on making money off of these things. Now is the time to just advance the mission. One of the benefits, I guess, of being a nonprofit is, we have a lot of generous sponsors and donors who make it possible for us to do that. So that's exactly what we did.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Jeff McDermott, President and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts and the Great American Songbook Foundation, about what the last year and a half has been like for the Center of the Performing Arts, for the Performing Arts, I should say. Jeff, with things going up and down during this pandemic, we never know when things could close down again. Do you think you're more prepared this time around should we end up back at square one?
Oh, I think we absolutely are. I think we were actually a leader in really making sure that we were taking all of the steps necessary to make sure that we had a very safe venue, that we were providing ample protection to our patrons now that they're coming back, and we had rental events and things like that during the shutdown that we were able to do, and we made sure we protected them, protected our artists, protected our staff members, and everybody else who enters into our venues. We actually created a document called Restore Go, and it became our Bible on everything involved in dealing with this pandemic. It was a great piece of work. Very detailed, and actually we shared that. We felt it was important to take that. We shared it with our six resident companies and other arts organizations around the community. You know, our thinking was we came up with this. We thought it was effective. Other people did many things, and we did a lot of other sharing, and we got a lot of other great ideas from other arts organizations. So people really pulled together, but I was proud of the leadership role we took in that.
And when it comes to arts as a means for folks to cope with what's been happening in the world, do you see that the Center for the Performing Arts is key to that?
You know, I think we absolutely are. And I've said to more than one person or one organization that I think we're not just key to it. I think we've got a responsibility. I think we are part of the recovery. You know, the arts are something that, has emotional impact on everybody, you know, this country and frankly the world over the last 16, 18 months has been through a pandemic, has been through a lot of social unrest, political unrest. But you know, you can always say when you go to a performance, whether it's at the Palladium or one of our other venues or anywhere, you walk in and you have all sorts of people from all different walks of life. But when you're in there and you look around, they're all there with a singular purpose, and that is to enjoy the performance, enjoy the music that they're about to hear. And it's a very unifying thing. And we take that very seriously. And we know that we've got a responsibility to do the right things and bring the right artists and be part of the recovery of all of this. And I'm hopeful that we're doing that.
And when it comes to the productions that are coming out this year, can you give us a little sneak peek about what's happening?
Absolutely. So we have been very busy. We normally this time of year would have announced our entire season, you know, 50 to 55 Center Presents performances. We've announced about 48 of them so far. And the reason for that is because of the pandemic, there still are some national and international artists that are still kind of working through their touring. But you know, we've got a great season already planned, and we're going to be dropping in some more performances as we go. For instance, just Monday, we announced John Legend will be here on October 20th, which we're extremely excited about. But, you know, we have pretty much every genre you can think of represented on our season this year, whether it's classical jazz, songbook, pop, rock, country, comedy, international offerings. You know, some that I'm really looking forward to this year, Clint Black, Randy Rainbow, Dave Koz always does a great show at during the holidays, Ben Folds, David Sedaris, Jazz at Lincoln Center with Wynton Marsalis. Of course, we always have our own artistic director, the wonderful Michael Feinstein. He'll be performing with Sandy Patty this year. Itzhak Perlman, the great violin virtuoso. Some tribute bands, 1964 tribute to the Beatles, Life and Music of George Michael, and a lot more. So we're very excited about this season. It may be about as diverse a season as I think we've ever presented.
Yeah, it sounds like a very wide variety, very impressive. And I just want to take the time and say thank you for joining us this afternoon. We look forward to seeing what else is coming out of the Center for the Performing Arts. Jeffrey McDermott, President and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts and the Great American Songbook Foundation. Coming up, Indiana has some cities that are ranked in the annual American Fitness Index. Did we rank well, or is there much more work to do? Stick around and find out. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We've had a few shows where we discussed fitness in the midst of a pandemic. And while that may not be the most important thing on some people's minds with so many other things to worry about, the annual American Fitness Index has come out. And if you look at it, you might be surprised to find out who ranks number one as the fittest city and who's at the bottom. With us to talk more about the list and what it all means is Nicole Keith, Reinsheriff Institute research scientist and president of the American College of Sports Medicine. Welcome back, Nicole. It's great to have you with us again. The American Fitness Index, what exactly is it?
So the American Fitness Index is a ranking of the top 100 largest cities in the United States. And it looks at more than just fitness. It looks at the rankings in terms of community environment, which includes the built environment, recreation facilities, policies, and funding that are related to health and fitness. And it looks at personal health behaviors, such as how much we exercise or how many fruits and vegetables we eat, as well as health outcomes. So it's looking at a lot of things more than just being physically fit.
That's a great explanation. Thank you so much for that, because I think for most of us, including myself, when I see that, I'm like, oh, it's just who's got the best workout going on, which cities?
That's only part of it.
Right. Why should we be concerned with the rankings? I mean, when they put this out and we see these headlines, why should we pause and reflect and read about it?
Sure. So in terms of our own personal health behaviors, those are going to influence our health outcomes. So the more we exercise or participate in physical activity and the healthier we eat, the less likely that we're going to have obesity or asthma or high blood pressure or coronary artery disease or have a stroke or have diabetes. But we should also care from a safety perspective as well as a policy perspective. And I say that because the more people who are out in our parks, in our bike lanes, on our sidewalks, being physically active is associated with less crime. And so they're safer communities when people are out and in them. And in terms of the economy, it's better if you're out walking or biking, the likelihood that you're going to see something that you want to go into a store and buy or go into a restaurant and eat is higher than if you're driving by it in a bus or in a car.
And, you know, I'm thinking just when you're saying, you know, physical activity and just being out there more is even reducing crime. But also, I just wonder if it builds more community, you know, people are out and about with each other.
Oh, definitely. I agree, because you're seeing the same people in your community. And so the ability to be social with them and to meet your neighbors or to meet the people who walk around where you work or where you recreate. It does improve the social interaction.
Did the pandemic at all increase a city's ranking for physical fitness, just because there was a period of time when people weren't driving, everybody was home?
So we won't know that for several years. One thing about the American Fitness Index is it's a collection of self-report data as well as city-reported data. And it's about a year or two behind what is actually happening. So it's going to be a couple of years before we see the impact of the pandemic on fitness.
And when it comes to Indiana, I think there were two cities that were ranked in this study. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yep. So the two cities that were ranked are Fort Wayne and Indianapolis. Those are the two cities that fall within those 100 largest cities in the United States. And Fort Wayne's ranking was 78 out of 100, and Indianapolis was 94 out of 100.
Now, those sound like some low numbers. What could be causing that?
Sure. So what I will say about Fort Wayne is it improved 7 points from the 2000 Anthem American Fitness Index. So they're actually doing better. And remember, this is a year behind, or 2 years behind, so to jump 7 points is really good. Indianapolis remained about the same. And when I look at like what may be driving us down, some of them are unexpected, like the air quality index is pretty bad in Indianapolis, even compared to Fort Wayne, but especially compared to average cities or the best city, which was Arlington, Virginia. And then when I look at other things, I look at like our bike score, it's like how safe is it to bike, is pretty low. And the percentage of people with food insecurity in Indianapolis is pretty high. And even compared to Fort Wayne, Fort Wayne did better than Indianapolis in most of the built environment metrics. How many people are within a 10% or within a 10-minute walk to the park is also pretty low, and our walk score is also pretty low compared to Fort Wayne and also compared to the average cities. And I will just say something that I didn't say before is this also affects people's desire to live in these cities. And so it's also really important if we're trying to attract people to help with our economic development that we're paying attention to these built environment issues. And then in terms of policies and funding, the local complete streets policies for Indianapolis is actually really good. And Fort Wayne was about average. Indianapolis is 1 point higher than the average city. And the park expenditures per resident. So for example, in San Francisco, it's $102 per resident. In Indianapolis, it's $37 per resident. And in Fort Wayne, it's $71 per resident. So there are things that our policymakers could be doing also that makes the active choice the easy choice for our residents.
You know, that's interesting, the idea that people will look at these rankings to determine where they want to live. Because, I mean, I think that's probably in the back of my mind when I see these rankings come out, like, oh, that place is number one. Maybe we should go live there. But, you know, I'd have to get a job or something. is it surprising to see which cities came out on the top?
I'm not surprised because, first of all, these cities that are coming out on the top have a lot of green space and a lot of water. And so first of all, that improves the opportunity to be physically active. But also people, like you said, tend to gravitate to those kinds of communities. People are surprised that Minneapolis ranks so high. And what I will say in Minneapolis, I think is ranked 2 or 3 this year, is that Minneapolis has invested and has the largest paved trail system in the United States. And people are like, well, that doesn't help if it's snowing, except for Minneapolis, St. Paul clears their trails so that even if it snows, people can still recreate year round. There are also opportunities to ice skate there and snowshoe. So people are really active in Minneapolis and St. Paul 12 months a year.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Because usually when winter hits, it's like hibernation time.
Yeah. So people are encouraged to be outside 12 months. And it's something else that we can do in terms of our personal health behaviors, but also as communities, is to make it enjoyable to be outside in the wintertime.
Yeah. Is there anything that can be done on the role of us audience members, citizens, I don't know what we would call ourselves, but those who aren't in the health profession to get the people that are making these policies on board with doing things like cleaning the trails year round?
So I think we know that we can use our collective voices. You're giving us a really great stage today just by letting me talk about it, but to really bring it up. And when politicians come to your door and ask you to vote for them, you can say, our sidewalks aren't connected. My kids can't walk to school. I can't walk to the grocery store. What are you doing in our community? We want a trail so that we can actively commute from our house to downtown where we work. If we don't get in the forefront and say, these are the things we want, there's no way that policymakers will know that it's important to us.
If you have any questions or comments for the program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Nicole Keith, Regenstrief Institute research scientist and president of the American College of Sports Medicine, on the American Fitness Index and, I guess, fitness in general, and what we can do to improve it. I do wonder, Nicole, you mentioned the air quality index is something that's also looked into. I know with the recent fires on the West Coast and the air quality moving, like I've seen sometimes on my own app, like the air quality is really bad. Is that something we should be concerned about in the long run, air quality?
Oh, absolutely. For our environment, so for our plants and our trees, but for our lungs and of ourselves and our kids and our pets, air quality is really important. And what I don't want to do is to say, well, air quality in Indianapolis is pretty bad. It's not great in Fort Wayne either. I don't want that to discourage people to go outside. What I want people to do is pay attention to when they go outside. So at the peak of day is when the air quality is the worst. And so try to go out early or later in the evening to go for your walk or your jog and just to be aware of it.
I appreciate you saying that because I'm always getting in arguments with my mom. She's like, look at the air quality. And I'm like, I'm going to go out anyway. So when we look at sort of these rankings and these lists, how do things like access and equity factor into this? Is that something that is looked into to see where we need to improve things in terms of access to fitness and health?
Yes. So in terms of the fitness index, because we're looking at the whole city, every urban community has in the 100 cities, all of these urban communities have low SES and high SES citizens. And so since we're looking at the whole city, that should balance itself out. But when we look at access to physical activity opportunities, we know that there are disparities among people who are poor, people who are underrepresented minorities or immigrants, people who are older. Women and girls are less likely to be physically active than men. And so a lot of these health issues where we see health disparities happen and are parallel to the opportunity to participate and healthy behaviors like physical activity and healthy eating.
And how does one address these issues? I mean, obviously you're in this field and you're working on that, but how overall, aside from changing policies or...
So one of the things that is new to the Anthem ACSM American Fitness Index this year is that we looked at food insecurity. And food insecurity in Indianapolis is extremely high compared to the other cities. And so part of what I see happening, and I live in Indianapolis, and so what I see happening in our communities as stores shut down and there are food deserts, I see urban gardens going up. And I see food delivery happening from like Indy Urban Acres, which is a huge farm on the east side, that there are communities that are trying to address this. The challenge is, even though we are looking at food insecurity, some of these, it has to be reported somewhere. And if there's no index for how many farmers' gardens or how many community gardens there are, then it becomes a challenge for us to say, hey, Indianapolis is doing much better because they have all these community gardens and they have Indy Urban Acres. But what it is that we have to find ways within our own communities to feed our community members.
Absolutely. Well, you know, when it comes to these lists that come out every year, it's great in the way that they draw attention to the topic. But I'll be honest, I think a lot of us will forget about it until the next list comes out again next year. Are there things that can be done to keep this kind of information at the forefront?
Well, I think sometimes people want to forget about it because they don't like what it says.
Yeah.
And I also sometimes when I look at especially this index, I wonder if people really understand like what physical activity is, because the percent of people who are exercising in the previous month or meet the aerobic activity guidelines or the strength guidelines or bike and walk to work, like, are they really paying attention? And there are items on here that count as physical activity that people might not consider physical activity, like vacuuming and sweeping and mopping and dusting and gardening and mowing the lawn and planting flowers. These are all physical activities. So part of it is giving yourself credit throughout the year for the activities that you do every day, or when you are driving your car, parking in the first spot you see and not trolling the lot for the closest spot, or if you're on the bus and you feel safe getting off a stop early and walking home to put more extra steps in your day. So every day, think of places where you can reward yourself with physical activity.
That's a great way to look at it, sort of a more positive, instead of criticizing ourselves, like, I didn't get enough walking in. It's like, just park a little further and get some walks and get some steps in.
Yeah.
What is it that has changed? I've been wondering in terms of our attitude toward health and fitness. Like, I've noticed there's been more concern with eating healthy and working out more so than, let's say, 20 years ago. But I often wonder if this kind of obsession, especially when it's like played out on social media and stuff, is more a sign of privilege than actually where we are in terms of health and fitness overall as a community.
Well, I would say that it is not a sign of privilege, because I work with people from all over the world, and people from developing nations are as concerned with physical activity as we are. Since we're talking about the American Fitness Index right now, I will also say that there's a lot more information. And so not only does the American College of Sports Medicine put out information, but healthcare organizations do as well. Schools are teaching our kids how to be healthier. So there's just a little bit more education. And so people who, when this started, were children, they're now young adults. And so they're implementing those behaviors because they're in control of their lives, somewhat anyway, and they can make this health behavior decisions with information that they learned when they were young. So we have to just keep talking about it and informing the whole population, not just the kids, about what physical activity can do for health outcomes and healthy lifestyles and longevity.
And I like how you mentioned just the different activities going back to, you know, like mowing the lawn or vacuuming or whatever can be forms of physical fitness. And I often wonder if for some folks, because when we think physical fitness, we think of like, oh, the Olympics are on right now. You have to be a super athlete. It's easy to get in our heads and not do anything. So as we get ready to wrap up here, what are some tips, if you could offer, for our listeners to take that first step?
So I think the first step is counting everything. And so if you walked up the stairs today and down the stairs and up and down again, that's physical activity. And if you are walking around where you work or where you live, that's also physical activity. So I don't encourage people who were not physically active previously to start at the gym. It can be a little bit discouraging. That's a goal, perhaps. But first, you just want to get yourself moving. Go for a walk. If you have a dog, take your dog with you. If you have kids, take them to the playground. Don't watch them play. Play with them. Swing on the swings or slide down the slide or whatever. Any movement is healthy movement.
I'm going to use that as my new mantra. Any movement is healthy movement. Thank you so much, Nicole Keith, Regenstrief Institute research scientist and president of the American College of Sports Medicine. Up next, we'll hear about a really unique discovery by researchers in New Mexico that could change the way we get rid of viruses like COVID-19. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. A new discovery by researchers at the University of New Mexico could change the way things are sanitized when it comes to COVID-19 and other viruses. With us now are two of the researchers involved in the study, Dr. David Witten, distinguished professor at the University of New Mexico's Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering, and Dr. Eva Chi, professor and Regents lecturer at the University of New Mexico's Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering. Welcome to you both. David, I'm going to start with you. Let's get some background on this discovery. When did you start researching and working on this project?
Well, we started working on this project, I would say, about 15 years ago. We have been working with some materials. They're polymers. They absorb light, and they also emit light, typically in the visible. They absorb in the ultraviolet or just into the visible. And we found these materials were, first of all, very good sensors. They absorb light, and they can fluoresce. That means emitting light. And we could interfere with that by a variety of ways, and that would give us information to understand the presence or absence of some species and so forth. And then we found a killed bacteria in a study that was published 15 years ago, just as I moved from a startup biotech firm to the university and joined the center here at Center for Biomedical Engineering. And what we found was that if we irradiated these polymers in the presence of two different bacteria, we used E. coli, a very common bacterium that can be pathogenic. And we also used anthrax spores. Again, everyone knows about the toxicity of the spores, but we were using a strain that wasn't toxic, that we could work with in our labs. And anyway, we found both the spores and the E. coli were killed when we had our polymer present in suspensions in water. So that's how it got started. And we've been pursuing it very highly collaboratively since I joined the University of New Mexico. And Eva and I started collaborating, I think, just about when she arrived. And we've collaborated over that time, co-advised several graduate students, and it's been a very fruitful collaboration. And also, I think, very interesting, because by collaborating, we could do work that neither of us or any of our coworkers could have done by themselves or could have done quickly by themselves.
I think it's fascinating that you mentioned this was something that you started working on 15 years ago and that there was some documentation and evidence that it was a viable solution to kill certain things, bacteria or viruses. Eva, did the pandemic push you to work faster on this project to see how it really impacted things?
Yes, definitely. I think kind of the genesis of this project of testing the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19, you know, really came to us when we were all at home last spring. So we were kind of you know, aside from adapting our classes to teaching online, there's this, you know, all of us have this general hope, general sense of, you know, kind of helplessness. And we were thinking, oh my gosh, how can we contribute towards combating this pandemic? Several of our colleagues, you know, started 3D printing earpieces for masks, or even making masks, you know, mobilizing their neighbors and friends. And, you know, we thought, hey, we have an opportunity here as well. Our compounds are fantastic at killing bacteria, spores, you know, any kind of pathogens that we've tested. And also some model viruses in the past. We published that study about 10 years ago. So we thought, wait a minute, this could potentially be good against the SARS-CoV-2 virus as well. So with this in mind, Dave talked to one of our other colleagues at the Center for Biomedical Engineering at Linnae ISTA, and she contacted an assistant professor, Allison Kell, who was hired in January of 2000, who just started in January of 2020 at the medical school. So the four of us got together and said, hey, let's test some of these compounds and see if they're active against the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So literally that collaboration, yes, it was definitely, we had the pandemic in mind, and we all of us wanted to make a contribution. And this was something concrete that we could come up with. And Allison took the compounds from us and started testing them in her lab. And we were so happy to find out that some of the compounds that we tested five compounds in that first round. And quite a few of them are really, really active against the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So I would say definitely.
Well, can you explain exactly like how this compound works to kill the virus? Because I know that there's some UV light that has to be involved, right?
Yeah, should I take that? It turns out that what we found out after our first discovery was that these materials that we looked at could be active in both light activation, visible or UV. And we'll talk a little bit about that, I think. But they also worked in the dark. And in the dark, they would take apart bacterial envelopes. And this was because the envelope is made of a series of smaller molecules that together form a mosaic in the envelope. And so our materials were capable of dissembling that envelope, and that let the interior contents of the cell drain. And of course, that kills the bacteria. And the bacteria has no way of really guarding against this, at least until now. And we haven't found anything that's been able to resist this and generate an antibiotic resistance type species. But anyway, we had done some work with viruses back in 2009, 2011. And we found that certain viruses that we looked at were very, very quickly inactivated by our materials. And these were viruses that are what we call non-enveloped viruses. In other words, the DNA or the RNA that's in the virus is relatively accessible. And they were easy to inactivate. But SARS-CoV-2 is an envelope virus, and it has a protein coat around the virus, which is very different from like a bacterial cell envelope. And so we suspected that there might be interesting things that would happen with this. And in fact, what we found is we had lost the path of dark reactivity, but we were very, very efficient at killing under the irradiation with light absorbed by these materials that we generated in our lab. And so that was why that's what we found. And we've been working with that ever since to really consider what applications we can address that would contribute to ending the pandemic.
And when you say ending the pandemic, I mean, do you think this is a viable solution to, I guess, tamping down on the spread of this virus?
I think so, especially because when the vaccine first became available, I thought, oh, this is wonderful. But, you know, if everybody gets a vaccine, we won't need our material and approach to solving the pandemic. But as you can see, during the last several months, what we found is there's an increasing core group of people who are really resisting the vaccine, no matter what they hear from scientists, biologists, et cetera. There shouldn't be any political problem with this, as far as I can anticipate.
Yeah, so, right. So some of the applications that we're thinking about is, you know, since the viruses are transmitted through droplets in air, and these materials could be easily incorporated into, for example, air filters, et cetera, so they can capture and destroy viruses better than what we do right now. They can also be incorporated into fabric and surfaces. So in a way, these are, you know, kind of more all-purpose antiviral and antibacterial materials that could slow down the transmission that ultimately. So another really advantage of these materials is that, you know, when we take a vaccine or take an antibiotic, it's pretty specific towards a particular strain. And obviously there's a lot of talk about, you know, is the vaccine effective against this new strain? The way that we know about how these compounds work is that they are nonspecific. Of all the pathogens that we've tested, through the two mechanisms of action, kind of the dark mechanism of disassembling the bacteria and viruses that we've seen, they're really nonspecific. So we expect these compounds to be active towards different types of bacteria and different types of viruses as well. This is so we've investigated how these compounds work against bacteria pretty in depth during the last 10 years of our collaboration. And we're just awarded a grant from the National Science Foundation to figure out exactly how these inactivate the SARS-CoV-2 virus. We're also expecting, what we expect to find is that they're active against multiple targets on the virus. So making these materials generally active against current and future emerging viruses.
I mean, that's remarkable that you've discovered this stuff. And I'm thinking just, you know, how we waited for the vaccine to come around and it was going to be a solution. Do you think this discovery you've all made would be ready for general use anytime soon, or at least maybe in hospital settings?
We'd like to think it could be available soon. The big holdup here is, just like for a drug, you have regulation. I mean, you can't just start to market something without it being tested and the testing being validated. And so our hurdle here is EPA registration. And that ordinarily takes several months. But again, it may be that due to the urgency of the situation, we can get some acceleration or some abbreviation of the testing. And that's our hope for now. But I think we can make the material on a large scale. We've settled on a couple of materials which really probably are our best candidates. And we could generate filtration depending upon who makes the filter material, and also the filter that we can coat with our materials. That should be fairly simple and straightforward.
Along the way, we have tested the toxicities of these materials against, you know, human cells, for example. And what we have found is that these are highly selective and toxic towards bacteria, but not cells, but not human cells. And we're also using these materials in other applications, and we've shown that they're not, we don't expect them to be toxic. But we do need to get through the testing and the EPA registration process in order for these materials to be used for commercial applications.
And what has the response been, Eva, from folks that have heard about this discovery? Do you feel like people are on board to get this pushed through?
In the way that we have talked about the science, people are very excited. Dave might be able to comment more on the on the efforts for to commercialize this product?
Certainly. So one of the first things we need to do in going towards a practical situation is find some suitable medium. We've tested typically solutions of our materials against suspensions of bacteria or virus suspensions. And what we really want to do, of course, is intercept these materials when they're part of like an aerosol in a room. And in that format, they're going to have probably some water that helps carry them around. And we can use that. But what we have to do is coat our materials on different substrates. And we've made some progress very recently. We've obtained materials from, for example, companies that produce wipes. We're also dealing with a company that is very much interested in filtration applications. And we're most excited, I think, about the filtration applications, because that's something where you can easily use our materials. When they're exhausted, we could replace them and put in a new filter and so forth. And so that's one of our directions right now of research, and we're making very good progress in that.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm super excited just learning about this and find it extremely fascinating and hopeful that this could help us get out of this pandemic eventually. What are your thoughts, Eva or David, either one of you want to answer this, to people that might say, well, just pour bleach on everything. We can just bleach everything. You know, it kills everything. We don't need special substances.
Okay. Bleach is a good example of a competitive technology using bleach. But bleach has some drawbacks. First of all, it's very corrosive, and bleach can certainly damage a lot of materials, including materials that you put bleach on. Often they're destroyed. On the other hand, bleach doesn't stay around very long. If you have bleach in a wipe, it'll evaporate. And if you've disinfected a surface by wiping a wipe containing bleach, you'll find that after 15 minutes or so, it's not active. Our material is not volatile. So if you had it in a wipe, you'd leave a coating there and the surface would still be active after some time. Also, bleach is dangerous. Our materials are not toxic. They only work when the light's on. And so if you don't want them to damage the surroundings, you just don't turn light on them at this point.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I do want to thank you both for coming on the program. We're just about out of time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you both, Dr. David Witten, Distinguished Professor at the University of New Mexico's Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering, and Dr. Eva Chi, Professor and Regents Lecturer at the University of New Mexico's Department of Chemical and Biological Engineering. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Cross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.